Today is Thursday, October 11th at 9:32 a.m., 34 I guess, according to my watch, we're a few minutes late. But we'll begin the meeting for the Wasatch Front Regional Growth Committee here at the Wasatch Front Regional Council offices. So why don't we go around first and do introductions. I'm Salt Lake County Mayor Ben McAdams.
I'm Andrew Gruber with Wasatch Front Regional Council.
John Barber with Morgan County.
Charles Henderson with UTA.
Alicia Christensen with UTA.
Jim Tobel with Farmington.
Mike Daly, Syracuse.
Katie Witt, Kaysville.
Katie Gerard, Wasatch Front Staff. Brad Martinson, Salt Lake Chamber.
Mark Allen, Washington Terrace Mayor.
Bill Summercorn, Salt Lake County.
Jeff Scott, Box Elder County.
R.A. Bruning in Vision, Utah.
Evan Curtis, Governor's Office.
Wade Bittner, Tooele County.
Jim Ryder, Mayor of West Jordan.
Dave McCall, Tooele City.
Reed Ewing, University of Utah.
Ken Knowlton, WFRC staff.
Let's go around here on the sides.
I'm Ned Hacker with Wasatch Front Regional Council staff.
Linda Johnson with Reed, Utah.
Roger Borgen with Utahns for Better Transportation.
Russell Weeks, Salt Lake City Council Office.
Rachel Otto with the League of Cities and Towns.
Scotty Riding, White Savannah Linux.
Heather McLaughlin-Cole, WFRC staff.
Louise Davenport, WFRC staff. Callie New, WFRC staff.
Hugh Van Wagenen, WFRC.
Jory Johnarks, WFRC staff. Scott Fetz, WFRC staff.
Alex Roy, WFRC staff.
Eva Roberts, ETA.
Megan Thompson, WFRC staff.
All right, well, thank you. Mayor, go ahead and say hello.
Hi, Mayor Kurt Bradner from Saint City.
Thanks for being late.
And no problem.
Jeff Harris, Department of Transportation.
And I talked to Mayor Dawn Ramsey. She is on her way, but she had a commitment that was going to delay her just briefly, but she'll be here a few minutes late. So first of all, our first item is to review the minutes of August 16th. Are there any comments on the minutes? And seeing none, is there a motion on the minutes? Motion and second to adopt the minutes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Minutes are adopted. Before we get into our regular agenda, are there any members of the public who would like to make a comment at this time? All right, seeing none, let's turn to the chair report. There are a number of interesting efforts underway that have been convened by state legislators that I think are of interest for us to discuss. An Inland Port Authority, the Commission on Affordable Housing, and the Point of the Mountain Commission. So I think it would be good for the committee to understand basically the status of these efforts. Andrew and his staff have been following these very closely. Maybe Andrew, would you like to bring us up to speed on these various efforts?
Sure, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to. And we can tick through each of these. There are a lot of people actually in this room that are involved in each of these efforts. So maybe I'll give just a quick status report and then look to anybody else who wants to contribute thoughts. Going in order here, the Utah Inland Port Authority, everybody knows that the prison, the state prison, is being moved to the northwest quadrant of Salt Lake City. In a way related to that, the legislature passed legislation, not without controversy on the structure and process, but passed legislation last year to create a new authority to govern in a lot of ways the elements of the land use and the tax structure for that area in the northwest quadrant, with the idea of bringing an inland port. There seems to be no disagreement that it is an area that is well suited for an inland port. There is continuing disagreement, I would say, unfortunately, around the governance and decision making. At this point, that Inland Port Authority, as Mayor McAdams said, created by legislation, and that's a theme here across these topic areas, established a board made up of public sector and private sector, a mix of legislators, county and local officials, and private sector folks. It has three sort of working groups going right now. One is coordinating the search for an executive director for the Inland Port. The other is to put together an Inland Port business plan and budget. And then the third is to look at the tax structure, the tax differential, what will be done with the incremental revenues that come from the Inland Port. While all that is happening, the Inland Port Authority is also putting together a technical advisory committee to develop the infrastructure and land use approach for what that inland port would look like. Ted and I actually met with Derek Miller, who's the chair of the Inland Port Authority, last week to talk about opportunities and options there, and I think that advisory committee is going to be coming together in the relatively near future. So that's just sort of a quick status report on where things stand, but Mayor, I would open it up to anybody who wants to add substance to that, who's been involved in it. Or not,
okay, see, no,
as the
no,
case may be. Okay. Okay, should I keep going then?
Let's keep going.
Okay. Second is the Commission on Housing Affordability, also created by state legislation to address and consider options for this real, I don't think it's too strong to say crisis that we face in our region, of the growth and then the demand for housing at all ranges of the income spectrum. So there's a difference between affordable housing, which is housing that is available for folks at the lower income end of the spectrum, and then housing affordability more generally, meaning that there are housing options at all ranges of the income spectrum. And that's what this commission is was set up to look at. Again, created by state legislation, but with a mix of stakeholders, legislators, local elected officials, private sector, community organizations. And there are six working groups that are involved in that, advisory groups: transit-oriented development, affordable housing production, leveraging funding and RDA resources, marketing and education, additional research and evaluation, and rural advisory issues. So all of those working groups. So many folks have been very involved in that. The Chamber, Bryn is here from the Chamber. She's been very involved with the Chamber's Housing Gap Coalition. Rachel's here from the League of Cities and Towns, and she's been very involved. I think it's yet another year of continual meetings. There's no break, as many of you will attest to. But that group, I think, appropriately is looking at the interplay of housing as it works with infrastructure, economic development, et cetera, trying to tackle these issues. And I think, Mayor, this relates to some extent to the discussion that we're going to hear from Y2 and others about perceptions around housing issues. Similarly, on that one, I would ask if there's anybody that wants to fill in some of the blanks on that. Okay. And Callie New from our, where's Callie? Has been working on this. Callie, is there anything I missed that I should add on that?
Nope.
Okay. And the third item is another significant thing that's happening is the Point of the Mountain Development Commission. Everybody remembers a few years ago with the move of the prison that I mentioned already, the state legislature created yet another commission, although that was the first one in sequence here, to look at what happens at that prison site, this 600 or so acres, and then the maybe 20,000 acres around there in some of the communities that are represented around the table here today. Mayor McAdams is a member of that commission. Mayor Bradburn is a member of that Point of the Mountain Development Commission. That has gone through three phases. The first phase was broad community engagement and visioning. And I should say that Envision Utah was hired as the consulting agency for a consultant for the Point of the Mountain Development Commission, and organize broad stakeholder engagement, and then that moves with that engagement into a planning process, what I would call a high-level planning of land use, transportation, open space. The transportation agencies, WFRC, NAG, UDOT, UTA, have been working very closely with Envision Utah and the commission all along in giving information to them and then also getting input from them. And that in a lot of ways feeds into the work that this Regional Growth Committee shepherds, which is the development of the Wasatch Choice 2050 vision and the regional transportation plan. So a lot of integration. We love all the engagement and the issues in looking ahead to the future. The third phase, which is just kicking off now, is looking at funding and financing of the investments that are needed around that area. Zions Bank Public Finance is involved in that process, and we look forward to the outcomes of that work, because There's one thing we know. There's more investments that are needed in infrastructure than there are resources available to pay for them, not just at Point of the Mountain, but in the entire region. So the tools that emerge there hopefully will be helpful in that area and then perhaps in the broader region. Similarly, I will pause and ask if anybody wants to fill in there, particularly Mayor or Mayor as members of the commission or anybody else, or Ari.
All right, seeing none.
Okay, that's a quick run through.
All right, well, let's move on to the agenda. We're going to discuss Utah's housing affordability gap and the Wasatch Choice for 2040. So we started to discuss the housing affordability gap last meeting. Today we'll discuss research findings presented from Y2 Analytics, a firm that was commissioned by the Utah League of Cities and Towns, the Salt Lake Chamber, and the Wasatch Front Regional Council. Ted.
Thanks, Mayor. Just a couple of quick thoughts on this. First of all, I just want to note that the reason why Y2 Analytics was selected is to inform a communications approach. And so it is to feed into the notion of how do we collectively talk about growth. And that is on behalf of the Housing Gap Coalition, which is convened by the Salt Lake Chamber, and Bryn Mortensen is here to talk about that as well. But the reason why we brought this to RGC is two reasons. One, we thought it would be really interesting for you as community leaders to hear about how residents are thinking about growth. But two, would like you to think about, well, how does this relate to the work of Wasatch Front Regional Council? How does it affect transportation infrastructure demands and the way people travel and how those things interact with land development, which is kind of the subject of Wasatch Choice 2050. And so I encourage you as Scott goes through his material to think about some of those questions, and then we'll have a discussion on those items afterward. Thanks.
Very nice to be here. As Ted mentioned, we were originally hired partially to understand both the current landscape of public opinion in reference to growth and in reference to housing issues, but then also to try and understand, well, are there ways we can talk about this that will help people understand what we're facing? The basic answer I'm going to share with you today was a surprise to us. One, the scope of the communication problem is, I think, even bigger than perhaps we suspected. Maybe some of you suspected that. And two, the answer is not as much in communication. It's not as much in the things we say. It has a lot more to do with the things we do. There are things we can say. People are sensitive to the fact that this is a crisis. But the most important thing when it comes to public opinion and housing projects is exactly the composition of those projects. So we'll walk through it. So here are basic findings. One, the public really cares strongly about this issue. For the first time, this tops the list of most important issues to voters across the Wasatch Front, which is something that we've never seen before. Usually you see at the top education. During recession, we saw jobs. During an inversion, you might see air quality. But for the first time, housing affordability is the number one issue, according to voters. Nearly two-thirds of voters see their communities as growing too quickly, that this change in pace has been rapid for them. And I think we're a little bit ahead of public opinion in many communities. And then the part I want to hammer on and spend most of my time is three, the type of growth matters. The substance of these projects is the most important thing. And if we're proactive about addressing the most common hang-ups in a given development, we're more likely to be successful. And then the final thing is just there's no silver bullet. I know there's a lot of people thinking that if we could just go back to building single-family homes in all these areas, we would get the public with us. The answer is no, actually. There are plenty of single-family home developments the public's not interested in. We have to think about these projects holistically. So I'll walk through each of these. So this is a question we ask on most of the work we do among voters. Right now, you know, this list of issues, what would you say is the most important one to you and to your family and to our community? And the number one issue for the first time is housing affordability. And you'll notice that about 70% of the public mentions something that's directly related to growth: air quality, education, infrastructure, water supply. You'll notice, though, that 22%, that's just a slim plurality. I think it's an emerging issue. This is something that's new. is starting to come into the forefront of voters' minds for the first time. And so there's some room here to educate, inform, and help shape public opinion over the next few years, but it's moving very quickly. And this is the underlying dimension here, which is that people think we're growing too fast. Okay? We asked, which of the following statements best reflects how you feel about the pace of growth in your city or town? You'll see that 33% said we're growing much too quickly. 30% said a bit too quickly. Right? So a lot of people think this is moving too fast. We've got to help them come along. That said, the people in this room have a reserve of trust to draw upon. We asked about different stakeholders in this process, including local government, community groups, real estate developers, the legislature, the governor, some groups like the Housing Gap Coalition, asking, you know, what is their role? Do they have a responsibility to help us understand and to guide this growth? And two, do you trust them to do it? And this gap here that I'm showing you is about how much what am I going to call this? I guess responsibility to trust gap, right? People think that their local municipal government should have some responsibility, and they trust them quite a bit to handle this. Whereas, for example, some of the private groups, like developers, while they believe they have a responsibility to have to be play a part in it, they aren't trusted to take a key role. And so the people in this room are the people that have the best chance of influencing public opinion on this issue. So how do we do that?
Can I just,
yeah, go ahead.
Mind a quick interjection? I wonder, do you all think that that is changing, that the level of trust that we're experiencing as community leaders is changing?
Yeah. Well, we're having, we've had several things come pop up where the Planning Commission passes something, City Council passes something, and then the community wants a referendum on that. So I think that is indicative of not trusting the local.
That's a really good point. Yeah, partially, I'm not sure how this has moved. To your point, maybe 10 years ago, this was at 70%, now we're at 40%, right? That said, of all the actors that are available to us, you're still in the driver's seat in that sense. And part of my goal here is to show you, well, how do we preempt this? How do we get ahead of this? What do we do as we're in the planning stages to bring the public along so that when something is released, it's not a shock, it's not a surprise? I can't promise that referendums won't happen. Part of this is that the environment is such that a lot of just the topic of growth is very sensitive to a lot of people. But my goal is to try and equip you, right? To give you, if we're going to try and get to that point where we can get a development through that our community is comfortable with, what does that look like?
Could I ask a quick question? The gray bar stands for what, and the orange bar for what?
Yeah, good question. So gray bar is who they think has responsibility for planning and communication around growth, and the orange bar is how much trust they place in that institution.
Thank you.
Yeah, very good question. So this is a hard thing to research. Okay, so what I'm sharing with you is public opinion surveys. These are complicated issues for residents, right? They don't sit around and think about planning decisions all day. They don't think about infrastructure. And so what we decided to do is use an approach that will strike you as kind of a game, okay? And the whole goal here is to statistically identify what is the marginal benefit of any aspect of a housing project. So let me give you an example. Say you're a respondent to one of our surveys, and I said, you imagine for a moment that a housing development is going to be built in your community. You need to decide which of the following two, you have two options, which of these two would you prefer? Read these descriptions and indicate which of these two you would prefer the most. Now on the back end of the survey, we're randomly selecting items that go into each of these categories, okay? So there's a number of different attributes. So on the left, for example, this housing project would be duplexes, it would be 30% owner-occupied, 70% rental, parks within walking distance, a mix of housing and businesses. It's been approved through a ballot referendum, et cetera, right? So a bunch of different components. On the right is a different project. Again, every single piece of this has been randomly selected. Over the course of our 2,200 respondents, we tested just about every random possibility of a housing development to try and isolate what is the exact effect of the fact that it's mixed use for housing and recreational and not businesses, right? What's the marginal effect of mass transit being easily accessible from this housing unit. And the whole goal is to isolate every single piece, right? Along those lines, we tested housing type, so apartments, duplexes, luxury apartments, single family homes, number of new occupants that would be moving in, proximity to amenities, mixed use features, the approval processes, which is mostly about did the city council do this? Is this the planning commission and the city council? Is it a ballot referendum? Transportation access, mostly mass transit, density, so how packed in are these units going to be, location in the community, which is everything from in my neighborhood to on the outskirts of my neighborhood to greenfield development, and then infrastructure accommodations, which is mostly about roads in this case, which is what people seem to care most about.
Scott, can I just quickly comment that as I look at those things, I think about how many of those affect transportation in some way. Proximity is distance of driving or distance of bicycling, mixed likewise. Access, what is the transportation access to different kinds of facilities? I think transit is one of them. Density has various transportation implications, location in the community, edge of community, part of community. So I was just thinking aloud about that list from that transportation perspective.
I think that's absolutely fair. In fact, let me jump to the actual results here. So what I'm showing you is the marginal effect on public opinion, meaning their willingness to accept, to approve, or select a given development based off of each factor, okay? So each of these is, if you take two housing communities and they're exactly the same, except this one is a biker or drive short distance to mass transit, and this other one is not. What is the marginal effect on the percentage of people that will approve it? Okay, and the whole game here is to get a majority of a community, or as high as you can of a community, to accept a given development, right? And something to notice is that the top ones are mostly having to do with housing type, with density, and with infrastructure and transportation. Okay. Those are the top ones, but I'll show you. The truth is no one dominates, right? Our highest scoring thing is, of course, single family homes, but that's in about the 20% spot, meaning that two different developments, one's townhomes, one's single family homes, you're only earning about 20% more of the voters because it's single family homes, because all these other attributes matter. It's a global game. Okay, so let me give you an example here. Let's say we're doing single family homes, but they're going to be rental units, right? They're residential, no mixed use. There's about 2,000 of them. This is a huge complex. No new roads or parking, which, you know, beyond what's just internal to this neighborhood. It's been approved by the Planning Commission and the City Council, but no citizen input beyond what's required. So there was no aggressive communication campaign about this. It was simply going through a standard municipal process. There's no real access to mass transit. School and dining are accessible by car, and it's built kind of inside an existing neighborhood, right? This is frankly a worst case scenario, except for the single family home option. The rest of these are things that people don't love. And in this scenario, you're only getting 23% of voters who approve it, despite the fact that it's single family homes, because that's not a silver bullet. None of these are, okay? And in this case, this is absolutely a recipe for a referendum, right? That's the problem. So let me show you an alternative. Imagine a situation now where we have townhomes. It's a mix of owner-occupied and rentals, business and recreational mixed use as well, a few hundred new residents instead of a few thousand, new roads and parking as part of the consideration for the complex. It's been approved by the Planning Commission and the City Council, but that's been after a series of public meetings for feedback, in addition, above and beyond, a kind of proactive public meetings about what it is we want to do here. Transit is accessible without a car, walking distance to amenities, and it's built similarly inside an existing neighborhood. We get up to 56% of voters who approve that sort of a complex. Okay. So the basic answer, what we found, is simply that the key on any of these is coming up with a development project or a housing project that makes sense for where it's being put, and that all of these considerations matter. And we were heartened by this fact. So one note, and I'm not going to show the results here because they're not very helpful, but we tested a bunch of messages about selling this, right? Is there some public communication campaign that can have a big dent? If we just help people understand the crisis, is that enough to bring them along? And the answer is no, it has some effect. We can have some effect. And there are other groups that are pushing forward with public education campaigns. But it's minor compared to the actual substance of what's being proposed in their communities. So strategically, one thing I want to warn you against, I've watched, and I'm sure many of you have watched, as development projects have been planned, and then they get rolled out to a community with the idea of, here are some things that we're, like, developers are thinking or other actors are thinking, here are some attributes that we're willing to cave on. So we'll go to the public with a given project, and when they push back, we will negotiate and give them these pieces, right? It's a standard negotiating tactic. My recommendation here is that is a recipe to fail, because by the time you get to the moment where the public is pushing back, you've pretty much lost them on the development already. But this needs to be a proactive process. These items need to be added to the plan. They need to be proactively communicated. The public has to feel like they've had some feedback, and then we can go through other processes that I think we've had for a long time. But if we don't do this sort of thing more regularly, I think we're going to see at least as many, if not more, referenda going forward.
Could I ask a quick question? Last time I heard you present this, I had a couple of questions which I may ultimately ask, but I'm wondering, and I think everyone here probably would be wondering the same thing. This is a stated preference experiment or exercise. Do we know how it conforms to revealed preference? Whether it's a good predictor of how people will really react as opposed to a kind of a modeling exercise?
Yeah, no, that's a very good question. I would say that, I mean, it absolutely is a modeling exercise. And if you're asking, have we taken these and matched them up to, for example, sales data, market data, the answer is no. I think market's in kind of a, I don't know. Honestly, a lot of the market pushes are at odds with public opinion because they're two separate groups of people who are buying versus people who already own and have the ability to vote on referenda. But the bigger question is, have we been able to implement this somewhere and seen it happen?
Exactly.
I think the answer is we haven't had time, right? It's fairly recent research. But it's a very good question. It's something that I'd be intrigued by. In a lot of this kind of messaging or this kind of sensitive work, after you do the initial work, you roll out a field experiment or something to prove viability. We haven't had that chance.
That'd be interesting, for example, to see how your model predicts the reaction to Olympia Hills.
Yeah.
One last question. Are the data available generally?
They are. I think there is a full report, which I'm just waiting for approval from a couple of stakeholders that will be available very soon. But frankly, everything that we've presented publicly is available. There are cross tabs that I can get to you that are extensive if you want to go
deeper. Can we get the full data set?
Yes.
The university?
Yeah, in terms of the microdata to
yes.
run? Yes, absolutely. Let me put it through our ethics panels to make sure it's clear of all personally identifying information, but I think we can absolutely make that available.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I want to, before the professor takes us into the microdata, I want to just pull up a little bit, and I've seen some of this a few times, so if it's okay, I just want to share a few reflections that I've gotten from looking at this information. This has sort of busted some of my conceptions about what people think or don't think in the region. And one of them is there's this notion that, you know, in our communities, people want and support single family housing and don't want and don't support mixed-use, multifamily, transit-oriented development. Now, as an organization, the vision we have all said, we know as community leaders that we have to provide a mix going forward, but gosh, the people, it's so hard because they don't want it. What I feel like these two slides that Scott has just shown reveal to us that the story is more complicated than that. And it's not, you can't just say, well, the communities will approve single-family housing or support it, and they will oppose mixed-use or multifamily. And actually, it's more nuanced, and it really depends on all of the other elements of community planning and community engagement, et cetera.
I think that's fair.
Fair.
The other piece, and I'm glad you brought this up, because it reminds me of something I wanted to bring up. We went looking for regional variation, right? So you can think of it as contiguous variation. So what about these cities that are next to each other versus these cities? We also went looking for cities with similar build-out percentages in cities with very similar economic bases to try and see, are there patterns that are differences? And there's only one. Okay, there's one difference across different kinds of cities, and that's based off of current density. In municipalities where density is already above average, okay, for the whole, kind of this whole Wasatch Front area, in those areas that already have apartments and townhomes, it's slightly easier, in public opinion, for people to accept them. But it's only about 10 points, right? Which was a huge surprise to us. So for example, if I designed an apartment complex and then presented it for the outskirts of Salt Lake City, versus that same apartment complex further south, say, let's go into, say, Taylorsville or something, which have different density profiles. The Salt Lake City complex has about a 10-point lead in terms of public opinion over the Taylorsville one, which is not huge, right? It matters, but it's not huge. And that's about the difference. In areas that already have significant density, it's a little bit easier to propose new density. Yeah, good question.
Scott, let me just share something with everybody that happened last night at our city council meeting. We had a developer come in with a 221-acre development. And in that 221 acres, he didn't have 50 acres of open space, 38 acres of commercial. And he had over 1,000 units, housing units in there. Most of them were single family, but he also had townhomes, he had assisted living center, and he had senior housing in there. In that, and it was interesting how the community around there came and wanted to talk. We had 11 people come up and speak. We could have had a lot more than that, but I knew we were going to hear everything we wanted to hear in 30 minutes. Four were in favor of that, and seven were opposed to it. So you're always going to have that mix. And again, this was a fairly large development of 221 acres. And yet what the developer presented was, I thought, very well thought out, well done, well presented. The hard part that a lot of people were having was he was down to 6,000 and 7,000 square foot lots. And yet he had the wider roads, 50-foot wide roads everywhere in the subdivision. And that's one of the things that as we as a city always look at is how wide the road, because you get people, if the lots are too small, their driveway, they can't park their car on the driveway without it hanging over the sidewalk. And so it was just interesting to watch the same thing happen last night at our city council. I just wanted to bring that up.
One of the things that I reflect upon is, and tell me if how your research relates to this, but we can assess what people think across the spectrum of the population or likely voters. When a development comes to the Planning Commission and City Council, what cross-section of those likely voters is going to show up? And I think that the people in the middle of I love it or hate it, they tend to not come. And the lovers or haters tend to show up, and often disproportionately those that are really strongly opposed to a development.
As you say, recently, to find lovers has been surprising, right? Actually,
right.
The fact that there are some folks who showed up in support is I think, probably
people
a
with
fairly
a,
good sign.
A passionate opinion, yeah. They will show up. And I think that's one of the challenges that we have as community leaders is, well, how do we demonstrate that we've heard from that cross-section of likely voters and can tap into that and then make decisions on that basis? It's really difficult.
And I've seen it both ways. So we've been brought in on divisive municipal issues to find out. So City Council, there were 50 people who showed up and heard an earful about often recently golf courses, and golf course, whether it's going to be kept or not kept. And then we do a survey of the city as a whole and find that is a small minority. Other times we've gone in and for a similar outcome, 50 people show up, they're upset, we do a survey of the city of the whole, and that those folks represent the city, right? So it's hard to know. So sometimes when it comes to things that are maybe big stakes, it may make sense to spend a little bit more time trying to get a cross-section.
Do you have any statistics on the behavior of voters in a setting where you've got a city that is composed of longtime residents, been here a long time, and new move-ins that are coming in, with new opinions and new, about how those two groups interface with each other. Because we're finding a different opinion based on what's coming in, as opposed to what has been.
Yeah. So this work has a good cross section. That said, let me bring up an example. We've done a lot of work with Harriman City, and I know Harriman City has been growing very quickly, but there's also a base population that has been there for a very long time. And there was a question where we were splitting those folks out, and some of the survey had to do with growth. I'll tell you, recently, we can do surveys about anything, and yet some portion of the survey will turn into a survey about growth, right? There's an open box in there. We will get open responses about growth issues, especially in Harriman. And so we broke out this question of, are we growing too fast? The same kind of question out in Harriman City, by tenure in the city, and found that new people who had just moved in adopted very similar viewpoints as those who had been there a long time. So even folks who had just moved in the last 2 years were happy to say that Harriman City had been growing much too fast. And some of that city culture, right? You're a new move-in, you get to know people in your neighborhood, and their views about the city government tend to influence yours because these folks have a longer history here. That's my theory, at least. The other possibility is simply the whole drawbridge idea, where now that I'm here, you know, fill the moat, because let's not let anyone else get here. I moved here at this moment for this characteristic of the city. It's a tough challenge.
All right, well, let's move on the agenda to the next item on the agenda is the 2019 to 2050 Regional Transportation Plan and Funding Discussion. So we'll turn it over to Jory.
Thank you. First thing I'd like to do, you might have recognized a new face over here in kind of the staff section. This is Hugh Van Wagenen. He's our new active transportation planner, so I've asked him to say a couple words, introduce himself to the Regional Growth Committee, and then I'll jump into my presentation. So.
Thanks, Jory. Now I'll just take a minute. Again, Hugh Van Wagenen grew up in Holiday primarily, so not too far from here. A local kid, spent a little bit of time in Florida, lived there as well. I have a couple of degrees from Brigham Young University. Prior to coming to WFRC, I was the planning director with Linden City, and so this land use stuff is very close to my heart and very interested in that, in addition to economic development efforts and everything in between. And so excited to be the active transportation planner here and understanding that type of transportation plays into everything that this growth committee talks about and the future of our communities. So again, if any of your communities or staff members or you yourselves have questions about active transportation in your cities or anything else that I can be of assistance with, look forward to working with you and your staff members. And I recognize a few people from our meeting yesterday. Thank you for being there at the Active Transportation Committee. But look forward to working with you all, and thanks, George, for the time.
So I just want to note, so Hugh grew up in the WFRC area, Utah County, they pulled him down there, and we pulled him right back up here. The great thing, one of the great things about Hugh is he's working on active transportation, so biking, walking, paths, coordination of active living. But his job in Linden City was broader, was community and economic development. So he understands not just that transportation element, but how that relates to the larger development issues that your communities are facing. So he's going to be a real asset to us and to our communities and to you. So thanks a lot. We're happy to have him here.
Thank you.
I want to flag too, now I've heard Andrew say it, so now next time somebody asks where I'm from, I'm going to say, well, I'm kind of from the WFRC area.
Yeah, isn't that the way most of us think of it, right?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Thank you.
All right, well, thank you. I'm going to give you an update on the Regional Transportation Plan and the Wasatch Choice 2050. So, high level, big picture, Wasatch Choice 2050 is an umbrella component to everything we do here at Wasatch Front Regional Council and throughout our region. And there are three elements within the Wasatch Choice 2050. So economic development, which produces a comprehensive economic development strategy that Scott Hess will produce on a yearly basis. The land use component, which is primarily focused and funded with monies that a lot of you here help support the transportation land use connection. And then the transportation component, which is the regional transportation plan that looks out 20 to 30 years and ties those together. So want to make sure we're all on the same page of what Wasatch Choice 2050 is and the Regional Transportation Plan. I'm going to focus mostly on the Regional Transportation Plan, although we did develop a lot of the Wasatch Choice 2050 components throughout the RTP process.
So, high level overview of what a regional transportation plan is. We have to update it every 4 years, so it doesn't sit stale on a shelf. We get to refresh it, get new ideas. It has to look out at minimum 20 years. This plan looks out 32 years. It's probably the longest our plans will ever look out. Normally they fall within the 20 to 30 year range. It's the regional blueprint that looks at all long range planning from economic development, transportation, and the land use. It ties them together. It has to be financially constrained, so it's not just the wish list of projects that fall within this document. It's very transparent and a lot of input. So we work very closely with planning partners, stakeholders, elected officials, communities on that. It ties to air quality conformity. So we get a state budget for air quality conformity for mobile sources, which make up about 50% of the pollutants throughout the region. We have to make sure that this long-range plan fits within the budgets that we're given from the state. And then we also have a process that we can amend this plan. So it's not etched in stone and for 4 years we just, you're stuck with it. We do have an amendment process that we can update it if needed. So that's the high level overview of the process. Here is our 4 year process that we've worked on for the regional transportation plan and the Wasatch Choice 2050 vision. The first component was let's explore new ideas. So in this plan, we had a plan that was adopted in May 2015 that looked out to 2040. We decided with staff input and coordination with our partners that we just didn't want to extend it 10 years. We wanted to take a fresh start at the regional transportation plan and look at it wholeheartedly. So our first roughly year or so of the plan was, let's just explore new ideas. And I'll go into a little bit more detail on each of these processes. We explored new ideas, we evaluated those and chose a scenario, and then we prioritized the projects. And that will all lead to this process. And throughout the whole thing, obviously we're taking stakeholder input. So the first part of that, exploring the goals. So, I'm going to give you on the next three slides an overview of the last 3 years of our process. I know a lot of you were part of that, but some of you weren't, so this is a little refresher, and then we can get to where we're at now. So, developed the Wasatch Choice 2050 goals. Those were adopted in October of 2016 by the Regional Council. This committee helped shape those goals, provided input to them, and we landed on those 10. I'll talk about input throughout the process, but that input includes local communities, so cities and counties, from elected officials and staff, our planning partners, UDOT, UTA, various stakeholders that are in this room. We meet with Reed at the University of Utah, we meet with Roger in the UBET group, and a handful of others. Some of the key landholders will meet with Kennecott Lands or Rio Tinto and a host of others, and then a public process. So we do a very extensive public process, mostly either open houses or ability to comment online. So this first workshop, you can see here, was very wide open. We had maps that everybody could just throw out any idea they thought where land use should change, where growth could take place, and then also we asked them to match up the transportation components of that. From that, at that George, workshop, yes.
Do you want to talk about the format of those workshops, who was invited to them?
That, for sure.
Has been one of the key building blocks for both the vision and the plan, these series of workshops.
Yeah, so the workshops, we do about once a year, and we invite local communities, and they're co-sponsored by the Utah League of Cities and Towns and the Utah Association of Counties. We invite the mayors or the commissioners, city managers, economic development, planners, engineers, city council, planning commission to these meetings. And so it's a wide variety from all within a community, because everybody within your city or county have different ideas and a different take on how the future should grow. And we wanted to make sure that we took all that input. Prior to going to these workshops, we worked very, very closely with UDOT and UTA to the point where they're almost an extension of our staff, coordinating not only monthly, but sometimes weekly or daily with both of our planning partners. And then again, like I said, we meet with our stakeholders, regional stakeholders throughout this process. But those workshops, you're right, Ted, are very key and important because WFRC is kind of the facilitator of developing the plan, but ultimately this is your plan for the future,
at the communities and the DOT and the transit agencies. So, the plan would be worthless without your input, I guess, right? The second component, we took all that input from the needs and developed three scenarios. So we said, well, okay, we have a general plan, you have general plans, and we have a regional transportation plan. So let's kind of use that as our base. We developed two additional scenarios with a different variety of center development. You know, should we have larger centers, but fewer of them scattered throughout the region with a variety of different transportation components that matched up to those? More internal roads with regional transit connecting those large centers, or more of a bus type system connecting smaller, fewer centers throughout the region. And so all these centers that we tested in these scenarios, and you can see them here, this would be Ogden City with down Harrison Boulevard, Riverdale Road, a variety of smaller centers with a different transportation. And so those centers were identified from that first workshop that you provided us. We did performance measures on those. We looked at, you know, what are the travel times? What's the safety? How? What's the ridership on the transit? How are they affecting community? So we, and as a reminder, all of those performance measures and this information in the process is on our website. Heather's helped create a really user-friendly website for us. So if you want to go back and look at the process, this is available online. The third component that we did was draft the preferred scenario. So we took input from the second workshop, right? We took the scenarios out to you to review. We got input on those. And then we developed a preferred scenario. So we had to take kind of, we didn't just say, well, scenario two was the winner, let's move that forward. We had to take all the input on all three scenarios and kind of mash them together to a preferred vision or a preferred scenario. We reviewed that against what are our existing conditions. Well, what if we didn't fund anything else and we just kind of went along as we normally do? And then the vision. We took that out, and this is our online interactive map, but you can see each one of these little pins were comments that we received just from the public. We also had hundreds of comments from our workshops. From that, this last May, the council endorsed the vision, which was kind of really a key milestone for us, and said these are the land use, the centers, the regionally significant land use centers and job areas, and the transportation projects that we need by 2050. After that, we go into the next step, which is to prioritize those projects and the land use within that. It's a two-tiered process. We look at one, when are projects needed? And then the second component is we have to financially constrain it. So I'll talk a little bit more about the financial constraint on the next slide, but to do that, we have evaluation criteria. And you'll see throughout this, right, everything revolves around the 10 regional goals that you helped us identify and set. We have a specific criteria per mode, score of 100 points, that we worked on either outputs from our model, we had geospatial outputs, or just input from local communities. Is a project ready? Has it had an environmental study? Those were components that helped us give a project a score. We've since reviewed those with your planners and engineers at our technical advisory committee, so that's a little plug. Continue to send your staff to our technical advisory committees. We get their input, and what we'll be doing is taking this out to you in this next workshop. I want to hit phases, though, really quick. So I say we prioritize the projects within the plan. So that means we identify in about 10-year blocks when projects are needed or when we think what you have told us the land uses would be starting potentially to develop within your communities. And so those are 2019 to 2030 for phase one. Phase two is 2031 to 2040. And phase three is 2041 to 2050. And then we have unfunded if, on the financially constrained component, if a project doesn't fall within that, it's outside of that part of the process. So does that make sense up to this point within our process? All right. So to do the financial constraint, we work probably on a 2 or 3 year process
Jeff has been very helpful with, this is a statewide effort to develop a unified financial model. So we work with the four MPOs in the state, UDOT and UTA, to create a model that helps us really predict how much funding we will have for all the transportation projects, maintenance, operation throughout the state. It's a heavily coordinated area. We worked very closely with UTA on their transit financial plan and scenario tool to help us assess when projects could be built, how much the operation of those projects would cost when you implemented them. And then we have a coordinated project cost estimates. So a project in St. George that's similar to a project here at WFRC or in MAG, they'll all be estimated with a similar cost. And so there's no game playing when we're looking for requests of funding for implementing projects for funding. So we review existing revenue sources. So we have a gas tax, we have registration fees, user fees. We assess all those and document them. We look at each revenue source and their growth rate. So we identify a growth rate on how we think those will grow in the future. And we look back at a historical trend. And so for most of our growth rates, we looked at a 20-year trend on what they would grow. And they all vary depending on the source. You know, sales taxes grow 4 or 5%, whereas gas sales and usage only grows at a percent and a half or so a year, right? And then we look at new funding sources. And we'll talk a little bit more about this. But on this plan, we've looked at local option sales taxes, vehicle registration fees, increasing the ceiling on the fuel tax. If you remember, it's sales tax based, and right now there's a ceiling of 40 cents. We looked at increasing that into the future. And then we also, on the transit side, identified which projects might be qualified for federal funding through the federal programs, New Starts, and things like that. One thing that should be noted is that all of these projects in phase one are the funding coincides with current law, right? So we're not whatever's been approved now is kind of what we've said will be good for phase one. And then phases two and three, we've increased some of our items a little bit more. Clarification, Ted or Andrew, on that?
Hey man, just
okay.
Just briefly, thank you, Jory. So just to make sure everybody's clear, that as we do this phasing, right, when there's literally billions of dollars of transportation investment that is needed, and the whole process Jory described looks at when those projects are needed, where they're needed, how it coordinates with land use and development, economic development, air quality, etc. Now, in theory, we could just say, well, here's what's needed, and hopefully the money will arrive. That wouldn't be fiscally prudent to just make that assumption. Candidly, it wouldn't be politically prudent to assume that the money will just magically appear. So it's really important to do a really thorough look at what is realistically feasible for the revenues that are going to be available for projects. Now, because we're looking at such a long time horizon, we also think it makes sense to not just assume that the sources that are in place today will be the only sources in place for the future. Because as the decades go by, additional revenue sources are identified. So it's a mix of looking back historically over time what has happened, looking at what sources are authorized today, how they are projected to grow into the future, and then what new sources might be identified. And so that's the whole process. And once we go through all of that, we apply that availability of revenue to the phased needs and then say, what projects can we project we will actually be able to construct and when? And so that affects the overall structure of the transportation plan for the decades to come. Phase one, essentially the next 10 years, and then phases two, which is the 30s, and three, which is the 40s. And the reality is we can't afford everything. There's a lot of needs that even assuming there will be revenue growth and new revenue sources cannot be afforded without additional changes in the revenues that are available.
Okay, so
I'll just add add briefly that within WFRC, there's the council, there's Regional Growth Committee, there's Transcom. Regional Growth Committee's responsibility is to focus on long-range planning. So we thought it would be really important for you to understand these assumptions, that you're aware of them, and if you have any thoughts on them, this is the place within Wasatch Front where we wanted to share this level of detail.
With those, we would like to show you, and Andrew, if you want to lead off the conversation, on the local option sales taxes. So we have up here Box Elder County, Weber County, Davis County, Salt Lake County, and Twilla County. And it looks a little jumbled, right? So I'll get you oriented. The first column here are the local option sales taxes. So you'll see that some of these are existing and some of them have a year next to them. So for example, Box Elder County has passed their first and second quarter local option sales taxes. And then what we've done here, you'll see these numbers are what we've made an assumption for what year that they would potentially be imposed in the future. Same with Weber County has their first four. The fifth is available for them to implement. Davis County, first, second, fourth. Salt Lake County, first, second, third, fourth, as of this year, right, on the fourth. And then Twilla County, first, third, and fourth. And so we also make assumptions on the split, right? So what modes can be used for our long-range planning on these funding sources? So we've assigned kind of percentages. What could it be used for, road or transit? And then you can see here kind of the total amount that would be available for our planning purposes, at least for the road and transit components of that. So
this is this analysis and exercise that we do on local option sales tax, again, is one of the sources that we look at. And we do this kind of analysis. So I'm backing up for a second. We do this kind of analysis on all of the revenue sources. Motor fuel taxes, what is going to happen to them over time? What is the growth rate going to be? What are the number of the gallons consumed? And we know that the motor fuel tax in its current form likely will not continue. It will likely be swapped out for something like a vehicle miles traveled fee or some other approach. So we look at that. We look at vehicle registration fees. We look at all of the funding sources and we take into account past trends. We also take into account the official state consensus financial projections that are put together by GOMB, the legislative fiscal analyst, and I'm missing one, the treasurer, I think the state treasurer. Okay, let's go with that. And those are official projections for the next few years. And then we also do financial analysis with financial advisory firms to help us look at projections beyond that period. So it's a broad effort that has a lot of detail and analysis around each of the funding sources. Now on local option sales tax, we wanted to highlight this with you specifically for two reasons. One, because it is the largest single source of revenue that impacts our plan that is directly controlled by the local communities. Two, because it is funding that goes to, the majority of it goes to cities, counties, and transit in the WFRC area. So it's a particularly notable source, okay? Now, Jory already explained this, but let's take Davis County as an example, okay? As you know, we sometimes refer to the local option sales taxes as quarters. It's not a calendar quarter. It's a quarter of a percent. So the first 0.25% and the second, they have already been imposed. They were imposed, in fact, decades ago. And they, 100% of those, by statute, goes to transit. And then you can see the rate. The first quarter is actually a 0.30 and the second is 0.25. In place already. They also, the so-called fourth quarter, authorized in 2015, imposed by Davis County in 2015, that's the split that's statutorily established. 60% is going to local needs, city and county, and 40% goes to transit. So that's that so-called fourth quarter. The third quarter is authorized in current law right now. Davis County, the county and the cities and county and the COG, as some of the local elected officials here will attest, are in a dialogue about whether
and when Davis County should move forward on imposing that so-called third quarter. But it is authorized by law. It is in statute right now. So for planning purposes, for the regional transportation plan, we make the assumption that it will be imposed, okay? And that those revenues will be available in the first phase of the long-range plan. So you see, presumption for planning purposes of 2020. Now, the so-called fifth is actually a rate of 0.20. That was created in the last legislative session. And that bill said, SB 136 said, if the counties on the Wasatch Front do all four of the other quarters, then they can impose another 0.20, and that will all go for transit. That's what the statute says right now. So you see it right there. Now that expires in 2023, so we again, it's a current law, so we assume for planning purposes that Davis County will impose that. And so that's why you see there those rates on the fourth and on the fifth. Now that basically translates to the other areas as well. We presume that on the Wasatch Front in Weber County, Salt Lake County, and Davis County, and I should note, this is true for Utah County too, this is what MAG is doing, that the presumption is that the existing local option sales taxes that are authorized by law will be imposed in the first phase. So first phase of the long-range plan consistent with current law, okay? We don't assume any taxes will be imposed that go beyond current law until the next phases of the plan. And that's why, if you look again at Davis County, a so-called sixth and seventh additional local option sales tax going for transportation, we presume in 2030, that's for phase two of the plan, and then 2040 for phase three of the plan. And we presume, for planning purposes, again, a split of that revenue between road and transit. When I say road, that can also mean active transportation. So I just want you to know that it is not set in stone that these things will happen, but for planning purposes and when we assume revenues will be available, we go through this exercise, and we have always gone through this exercise to try to project when we will have revenues available to invest for planning purposes. Now, if that wasn't complicated enough, we take a different approach for Tooele County and Box Elder County because they are less developed. And I would also note for Morgan County, as a so-called non-urbanized, as census defines it, county, we don't technically do the financial projections for Morgan County. That's done through UDOT, but we cooperate with UDOT in that process along with the Morgan County officials. So what you can see is in Box Elder, we have a different presumption of not adopting all of the currently authorized quarters in the first phase, but a more delayed adoption. So I'm looking at Commissioner Scott over here, a more delayed, because it may not make sense to do them on that same time frame. Tooele, having already done the first, second, and first, third, and fourth, and having the second quarter on the ballot actually in November, we contemplate for planning purposes that will be moved forward in the first phase, and then the so-called fifth quarter also would be. Okay, so hopefully that was relatively clear. And this is just one of the sources. But again, as Joyce said, we wanted to lay out for you the kind of work that we go through and the kind of assumptions which attempt to strike a balance. They are not overly aggressive in assuming additional revenues that aren't even authorized by statute will magically come available, you know, in 5 years and we can just build everything. But they do assume that the current revenue sources that are authorized in the law will be utilized, and that as time goes on, in decades into the future, additional revenues will be identified in later phases. And final thing I'll say is that, again, we revisit this process, as Jory said. So if the law changes, if the preferences change, we can go back and modify and adopt and make the reality impact the planning assumptions. Okay, I'm going to stop talking now and kick it back to Jory, but I think we should see, does this make sense?
I would ask, are there any questions or thoughts on this?
Well, I have a question. I'd be interested to see what you're thinking about for future resources.
that are coming up? Because as I look at the four or five that you're already using, those have been there for, in my opinion, a long time. So you go back to your constituents and you say, oh, here's the gas tax, this is what we're going to do. Well, ticks them off.
Right.
Okay. So how are we going to get some new sources that are less, I guess, so that our constituents don't get so pumped up over the stuff that always attracts with gasoline.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things I think worked was what we put on registrations and, you know, stuff like that, because that was minor, you know, versus going to the pump and adding another 20 or 30 cents or whatever. So I'd be curious to see what your plans are, or are there any plans?
Yeah.
I mean, you mentioned one. We're going to have more electric cars. You know, how do you do this? Because gas tax will go down, and you're going to have to formulate that somehow.
Yeah.
But I would be interested. I would personally like to know if you've got some things hanging out there that might be future other resources that you're thinking about.
Yeah. I'll just briefly. This is a great point, Mayor. We know that the current funding sources that are now being utilized to fund transportation infrastructure will not work over the be sufficient enough money or even the right sources over the life of the plan that we've got here. You could say that politically, and I would say it financially, they won't make sense. The gas tax clearly is not going to last as a relevant source over time.
Yeah, at some point in time, they're going to have enough of it.
Right. So what? The way that we approach this process is to make assumptions based on the current sources, but the way we really look at it is these sources or an equivalent source, because we know the gas tax will be swapped out to something, and there's a lot of work, and UDOT is coordinating a lot of work. I imagine Jeff may want to comment on this around alternatives to the fuel, motor fuel tax. So we make for planning assumptions, we project out using existing sources. But we also work with all of the stakeholders, and I mentioned some of the financial firms that are working now, the Point of the Mountain having some financial analysis going now around innovative funding sources. So that could be new funding sources that either have been contemplated or haven't even, and then also innovative financing. So value capture, tax increment, financing, alternative user fees around transportation, property taxes, do we look at that over time? Might even be more controversial than some of the things you're saying here. So in a way, there's two sort of separate efforts. One is to make realistic, feasible projections about the total availability of revenues, and then at the same time, looking at the possibility of innovative or alternative funding sources, either to replace these or to supplement them.
And how pertinent is bonding associated with this? Because bonding can be kind of a flat blanket over everybody if you want to work it that way. I'm assuming, is there less negative feedback by doing a bond situation versus a gas tax?
Well, we do project bonding financing in the plan, but again, a balanced approach, because as you know, bonding is a financing tool, it's not revenue.
Yes.
It just takes future revenue and moves it forward. But it's a realistic strategy. It's an appropriate strategy for infrastructure investments when done judiciously and when there's revenues to pay off that debt over time. But
I just wanted to make your point. You made it, Andrew. Actually, we talk about equivalency, right? And I think maybe that's the way you message it back. Yes, we have to assume gas tax. We use that terminology, but it really is an equivalent amount of new revenue or future revenue. We don't know all of what those potential revenue sources are, so we use the term equivalency, and I think that's probably the main message point that I would give back to you. Bonding, we do bond, as you know, the legislature passed a $1 billion bond 2 years ago. It's on future TIF revenues. Typically, though, when we do bond, it just steals from the back end and advances the front end, right? So they pull from there another. The other point that I would make in all of this, right, is, and Andrew, you brought it up very well, is if you look at our TIF projections and you look at the projections that UDOT uses, they are more conservative than the projections in our financial plan, and rightly so, both on the federal revenue side and the growth of TIF over time. We use the consensus number through the entire period of our TIF projections, Transportation Investment Fund projections. We only use those for the first 5 years in our financial planning projections. And we think that's legitimate. Again, we go back 20 years and we look at the growth of sales tax, and we think that's a legitimate index, if you will, to project in the future. So there are differences between programming and planning, just understand that. But again, we think we are very conservative in our projections.
I want to, one more question and then let's move.
And, yeah, I'm just going to be very brief. I'm actually making this comment specifically for you. Oh. And that is, if anybody ends up in Congress,
Not me.
But when we were looking at the five different areas where we get funded, I think there needs to be a concerted effort by states, especially states in the West, to keep our money in the state, not send it to DC for them to decide how to distribute it with strings attached, right? And I understand there's donor states and there's taker states, and I'm more than willing to make an offering, as it were, if I can keep that money here. As we're looking forward and gas taxes not being what they used to be, there's going to have to be a shift eventually on the federal level as well. Would it not be a wonderful opportunity to change how we do that, that process? So, just throwing that out there, and wouldn't it be great to work with other states and other planning districts and to lobby Congress to do that. That's all. Thank you.
That's an interesting thought. Thank you. All right. Well, I think this is incredibly fascinating, and we have a lot of work ahead of us.
Yes. So you might ask yourself, well, how do those funding assumptions affect the preferred vision, right? Really high level, the projects within the regional transportation plan are regionally significant local and state projects. So think collectors and above, so not the local neighborhood streets within the plan. Think active transportation, regional connected, larger, you know, network, gridded network, not the local active transportation. For transit, think the core routes or express buses, BRT, light rail, commuter rail, not local bus service. So with that, you can see here, that we're with the financial assumptions that we've made, we have a little bit over from $4 to $5 billion a year for the road component, with a leftover of about $2 billion. For transit, about $1 billion in the first two phases, save up a little bit in second phase to help with some of the projects in phase three, but there's still an unmet need or an unfunded of about $3 billion for transit. With the active transportation, we've identified when projects are needed, but we have not financially constrained the active transportation plan. There's about $600 million worth of active transportation projects, and we're assuming a little bit over $100 million of revenue. So we didn't go through and individually assign projects and try moving them forward, but on an aggregate, we're about $400 to $500 million short on the active transportation component of the long-range plan. Again, just the regionally significant projects for that. So total of all that is about $6 billion of unmet need just for the regionally significant capital component. That doesn't include maintaining your local streets or the maintenance of the state facilities, things like that. So we want to be very clear. It looks like we have it all set, right? No. Fourth workshop, right? And you have in front of you, we are looking for your input, local communities' input, in one of seven workshops. So hopefully, if you're a city staff or an elected official with the community, you've received your invitation. We've sent out calendar invitations about a month ago. If you did not, please find Katie after this meeting. We will be sending out an interactive map beginning of next week for you to review with your city, your staff, and kind of gear up to attend these workshops. So workshops are going to be held, first one's October 22nd, up in the southern part of Weber County, followed by, I believe, southeast Salt Lake County, and then South Davis. So those are our first three meetings. You can see them all on your map there. We've regrouped them a little bit. So we had 10 going through our process. We've kind of categorized them into these seven groups. And again, we're looking for input specifically on the phasing of projects. So we've done a technical, as I mentioned, we did a technical review scoring, but we know that there are other considerations to take into consideration for projects to be moved. So if, you know, if we need to move something, we'd one, like to know why and what are the considerations. And then two, come prepared to tell us something to bump back, right? Because it's financially constrained. So if we're moving things up, we also need to move things back. We have a public comment period from October 22nd to November 30th. Please go to our website. You can make comments on all of our projects, all the regional land uses on that that website. So with that, are there any other questions, comments, thoughts?
All right. Seeing none, thank you, Jory. Great process and a little bit daunting, so. A lot daunting. Jeff, you can be in charge of telling the legislature about what's happening in 2030 and 2040 with those, if that's okay. Okay. let's move on to the agenda on item number 6, the Future of Transportation and Land Use Connection Program. We all know this program. I think it's been an incredible program in Salt Lake County. I can't speak as to the other counties. I haven't seen it firsthand, but incredible partnership between WFRC region-wide. In Salt Lake County, we've infused some additional funds into this to do a little bit more. Also, a partnership with UDOT and UTA that helps communities advance their planning efforts so that they have regional benefits. One of the things that I've seen is with any transportation project, I see our cities are always struggling to fill the next pothole and maintain that road, and that budget, there's not enough for that. But we know that we've got to change some of the choices we make, and as our land use choices are changing and our population's changing, we've got to try and divert our course a little bit and not just focus on the pothole in front of us, but try and look 10 and 20 years down the road. And so this has been an incredible, I think, opportunity for our cities to receive grant funding from the county and WFRC to re-envision some of their land use and how that might affect transportation might affect land use, and try and change that course, our trajectory ever so slightly in ways today that will have profound impacts tomorrow. So with that, go right ahead.
Thank you, Mayor. And I'll start by saying the partnership is absolutely invaluable to this program. The growing excitement from our partners has been much appreciated, and it's really bolstering this resource for communities. So thank you, Mayor McAdams, Councilmember Winder Newton, Jeff, Charles, thank you guys for your support. Support from Salt Lake County, UTA, and UDOT has been critical. So I like to talk about this program and what it can do for your cities and what we're all the great work we're already doing. But I want to move through that stuff quickly today so that we can have a little bit of a discussion about the future of this program and how it can become an even better resource. So the goals up here, again, you've heard these before. The Transportation and Land Use Connection Program is planning technical assistance. The program supports local governments in their planning efforts implementing the Wasatch Choice vision. This program saves community time and money on administering these projects, paying a consultant to do them. We take a lot of that on and provide some expertise to do, among a lot of other things, provide some cover for city staff talking about these difficult issues. I'm happy to be going after the Y2 presentation where we talked about all of this pressure that our communities are feeling, our residents are really, really feeling. And it guides communities through a well-coordinated planning process with all the stakeholders that need to be there involved. One TLC project I want to mention, just because it's moving the needle in how we're connecting land use and transportation planning, the Cottonwood Heights Wasatch Boulevard Master Plan is really closely analyzing land use and transportation together, connecting the plans for those, acknowledging their futures, and then within the transportation master plan itself, noting the land uses along the corridor. There are a lot of projects in the program that are really doing some forward-thinking planning. Tooele County is one of those. I know Commissioner Bittner's here. In Tooele County, we started with the general plan, and now that's moved into what's almost complete, an active transportation implementation plan. So moving to the next step, Commissioner Bittner, if you want to say anything.
You bet. I was asked by Ted yesterday if I would spend about 35 minutes
and bring everybody up to date.
I'll go sit down.
But I can see the clock on the wall, so I won't do that. We started about almost 4 years ago looking at the transportation plan, our land use plan, and finding them horribly out of date. And so we made a determination that we're going to establish a 5, 10, and a 15-year plan and include those items in it so that we could update them according to our needs. That meant we had to look at what our goals were for the transportation. My responsibility was roads, and so I went to our roads manager and said, I want a list of prioritized road needs. He established that. We found one that was sadly lacking, and that was in our transportation around the corner on exit from Mills Junction over to I-80. That's a terribly congested area. So we put that as number one on our list of trying to solve it. We found that there was an EIS that had been performed a number of years before. And so I went to Carlos Braceros and said, what do I need to do to get this funded? He gave me a list. He said, you need to talk to the landowners. You need to survey the area. You need to purchase the property. And then we need to find a funding source. And it was already in the transportation plan for the end of 2040. I guaranteed him I would not be a commissioner in 2040. So we needed to do something a little bit earlier. And so we went ahead and did exactly what he said. We recognized the need that we had to educate ourselves first as to what the process was, talk to the right people, depend on the experts, because I'm not the expert on everything, just many.
Almost everything.
Thank you, almost. That was a good comment there. Almost worth the vote, right?
Okay. You're out of the district, so.
What can I say? Anyway, educating ourselves was very important, and I'm bringing that up to date. And so he told me what to do and how to do it. We used his people, we used WFRC and others to implement this plan. And then by God's grace, I can't attribute it to anything else, we had bonding available, we had money available, we had done everything necessary to get that plan updated and to get it funded. And to make a long story short, we are completing the engineering this year for the Mid Valley Highway, which is worth about $74 million. But it will take 25% of that bottleneck off of our corner going from Highway 36 to I-80. And simply stated, we were prepared, we were educated, we were headed in the right direction. When the money came, all we needed was a lobbyist just to make sure the legislature would see it our way. And so we did that, and we're able to get it funded. We appreciate everything WFRC has done, everything that UDOT has done, and we've even included UTA because now we're working on another road called the Ochre Connection or the Ochre Expressway, which will come from Willis City above the railroad tracks next to the mountain and go all the way through over to that critical juncture, so that in 2040 we will have a connection there. We're already acquiring the land, we're going through that process right now, and so it's an interesting thing. The greatest challenge is government takes a long time. I had one person in government tell me, Commissioner, you work too fast for government work. So I believe that, and we got that accomplished. There are a lot of detail I've left out. Sorry you missed out on the rest of the 35 minutes.
Thank you, Commissioner. I'm going to skip a little bit. So TWIL is a great example of a project that's just being moved forward through, partially through the work of the TLC program. 93% of the projects we've completed are doing that. They're moving forward into whatever the next step is. And we're really proud of that number. We want to keep doing that. So I want to talk now about emerging opportunities. So we know the region's growing. It's not a surprise. But this means planning is more important than ever, the way we're growing. And it also means that it's a little more political than ever. These short-term decisions that are being made in communities really find their way into the long-term planning on the local level. It also means that your staff is a little busier than normal, because all of these projects coming your way take a lot of their time. So if the TLC program is here as a resource for them to try and continue to think about the big picture issues, while recognizing that there's a lot of pressure on your cities right now. So I guess really I want to open this conversation that way, so that you can think about how TLC can be more of a resource for your communities in this time of growth that isn't looking to slow. Another emerging opportunity with TLC is this, the SB 136 transportation governance, corridor and area planning, really thinking about early agreements between stakeholders about how to coordinate land use and transportation futures and come to solutions that are implementable for all parties. We do a lot of this work, it's through the TLC program, but thinking upstream from that, really early on, where there's, you know, we have the Wasatch Choice Vision, there's RTP, Regional Transportation Plan projects running right through your centers. How do we coordinate early and often and on a more official basis, coordinate that land use and transportation thinking and for bigger geographic areas along entire corridors. We have multi-jurisdictional projects through the program doing more of that kind of work, working together across boundaries. And last, I want to mention another SB 136 provision, the transportation reinvestment zones. This is a funding strategy for your cities. We did produce, I want to mention on our website, we produced with Zions Bank and many stakeholders and partners, local government representatives, the TRZ white paper. This is more information, as much information as there is about transportation reinvestment zones to date. It's on our website. It's a good resource. I don't want to spend too much time on that because I want to get to hear from you all. Really just about, you know, what emerging opportunities there are with TLC and how you see this resource becoming even more prevalent.
So thank you. So we would love some feedback from you on the TLC program, where you see this going. Should it continue to evolve to meet some of the needs we're seeing, especially in light of the previous presentation about some of the immense needs that are coming at us? Love some feedback and thoughts on that.
Could I start on?
Yeah.
Some of you have heard that the TLC program was an outgrowth of a discussion on this committee 5-6 years ago. I forget exactly when it was. So we've always had a great interest in TLC. I recently, and I was aware of the fact there were about 5 programs around the country like this. But we did a survey of 25 MPOs. What we found is that about half of them have a program like this, provide grants to local governments for, this is a shorthand way of saying it, for land use planning. So it's a major shift for MPOs to provide money for land use planning. You can think of it as a way of making it unnecessary in the future to spend so much money on transportation, because land use is complementary to transportation. So that's one way to look at it. It also increases livability and so on. So anyway, I was aware of the fact there were about 5. There are many more. We're doing a national survey now. We've sent out survey forms to 404 MPOs, and Ted and Amanda Dillon, who's one of our master students, and I talked about TLC at the last Utah EPA meeting. Amanda
provided preliminary results of our survey. We've gotten about 30 of these forms back. And what I can say is that we are at the low, and we'd love to have Amanda give a presentation, maybe at some future meeting of the Regional Growth Committee when the survey is complete. But what we find is that we're at kind of the low end of funding. There are programs in the hundreds of millions of dollars. They typically start out with what we have, which is technical assistance and planning grants, and then over time add infrastructure grants to the mix. So you think of it as, maybe the planning grant is to develop a Main Street redevelopment plan, and then the infrastructure grant is to fund the streetscape improvements. And what we'll have for you is, we've already written one paper, and it's going to be delivered at the Transportation Research Board annual meeting in January. We'll have the results of the 404 MPO survey, and I think it will be really instructive as a way of kind of repositioning us. And so what I've been kind of getting at with this is that I would like to see us spend a lot more money on TLC. I think it's a really good investment. We've got a great partnership here, and so that's what I personally would like to see, and want to see how others feel about that.
And just a little bit on top of that, on the transportation side, as many of you know, we presented last time on UDOT on updating the prioritization process for our TIF capacity projects. And one of the things Senate Bill 136 asked us to do is take into consideration the land use impacts on transportation and transportation impacts on land use. And one of the reasons why we contributed to TLC is we really see it as that implementation, that missing piece in terms of implementing the Wasatch Choice for 2040 vision, right? And what we're hoping that would come out of this in the prioritization process is that we can reward communities that, one, buy into the Wasatch Choice 2040 vision, but then more importantly, actually implement the codes, the ordinances, the things on the ground that make that happen. And I think that's where we're going, and hopefully we will get to the point where we do reward that type of thinking and adherence to the plan.
One thing I forgot to mention, thanks Jeff, is that the demand for funds is currently, or has been, well in excess of the supply, and this is just for planning grants. So the three components are technical assistance, which you got, planning grants, and then infrastructure. And even just in the planning grant category, I think the demand is roughly twice the supply of funds. I think the applications you receive. So there is a demand out there. It's a popular program. It is popular in other regions as well. Already moved to implementation through infrastructure grants, and I think that would be the next kind of logical step. But the way other regions are doing it is they provide the year one funding for planning through a grant, and then it's implementation in years 3 through 6 or 10 of the plan that was developed in year one. So it's a kind of logical transition.
Right.
So I was just going to wrap it up. I think we're running out of time, but from the Salt Lake County perspective, from what the grants that I've seen funded and then the thinking and visioning that comes out of that is incredibly valuable. And it gets projects then envisioned and then ready, and then they can compete on equal footing for funding. And I think it has helped us to change our trajectory in Salt Lake County. So I would definitely love to see increased funding, knowing, I guess, and not knowing where that comes from, but I would love to see increased funding, because I know in Salt Lake County people are actively seeking more funding for these efforts. And it's hard for a city to come up with it out of their own budget. So, yeah, it's great.
And shameless plug, October 29th is the date for letters of intent for all of our funding programs at WFRC including this one. So if your communities are thinking about projects, as always, in touch.
All right, so we're 5 minutes over. Any other business? With that in mind, any other business? Okay, I would entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
We are adjourned. Thank you.